to encourage him to take early retirement.
We have recently been made aware of that.
Yes, sir.
I guess the idea is because of the budget crunch, you can thereby encourage higher paid professors to leave, and you can hire younger ones with less money. I think that's the theory behind it anyway. But are you aware of any situation where these people who have been encouraged to take early retirement are led to believe that part of the consideration for doing this is going to be that these early retirement the salary increases and other considerations will in fact be taken into consideration in determining retirement benefits? Are you aware of that contention being made?
Senator Fryer, it's my understanding that this last line was going to be amended, and I don't see any amendment anyplace. And
well, okay, I guess that's what I'm getting at. There's that.
We have not heard to our knowledge.
When I talked to the administrative assistant, right, I think that this was to be, and the way I understood it's going to read would be line 39 would read, any retirement incentive exclusive of payments to forfeit tenure, comma, retirement severance pay, comma, retirement, blah, 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 blah.
Do you have any objection to that?
No, sir.
Right. I was the one to talk it over.
Okay.
But they don't see
any kind of make amendments, I take it, your suggestion. Oh, we don't even have, yes, we do have a quorum. Well,
we have a quorum. I think I want to make sure that we have everything in line so people can comment or we understand what we're looking at and talking about, because we'll have, there are other people signed up on the bill, and I want to make sure that. Senator Fry, are you addressing part of the concern from the higher education people?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So they will be commenting on it as well, and okay. And I didn't hear the. Do you have it in writing? What you're suggesting?
Yeah, I've got it written down here. I suppose what I wanted to find out whether the PERS people were going to be opposed to that before we get along any further with this thing.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Fry, putting it rather bluntly but certainly accurately, the amendment was intended to incorporate the rules into the statute so salary would be restricted and clarified and cleaned up so that there'd be no misunderstanding of those individuals who were leaving, such as a tenured professor, who thought, in fact, that subject to salary or that subject amount was going to go into his final average salary. I think our clarification is we do not want a ballooning. If we are able to restrict it to reasonable understanding of what salary is and exclude retirement severance pay and income bonuses and gratuitous payments that in some instances have double salary in the last year and not in any change in position. We found that occurring, and we must audit, and we must reluctantly disagree, and we find ourselves in hot water that we think could be easily avoided if we would apply the rule and apply the statute. So we would hope that there weren't too many exceptions to it, because then, in effect, we would be obviating the need. But
you're more interested in kind of cleaning up the language and then solving policy matters then, really, I take
Certainly.
It. All right.
And you'll find that occurring in probably half, if not more than half, of the 10 amendments that we're talking about.
All right. And if, in fact, and I think there will be probably some testimony that the professors were relying upon that suggestion that would be considered, that you, if that turned out to be the case, you wouldn't really have any quarrel with the changes.
Certainly from a cost standpoint, there would be a minimal impact.
Yeah, all right. Thank you.
Do you want to move? Well,
I'll just tell the committee members where these words would fit in, and you can.
Okay, yeah, we can pencil them in, we can adopt them.
Pencil them in, or however, on line 39 of page 2, just exactly the way
exclusive of payments to forfeit tenure.
Right, those words would be placed in there after the word incentive.
Between incentive and retirement.
And retirement, yeah.
Exclusive
of payments
to forfeit tenure.
Okay.
Madam Chairman, that could add quite a bit to the retirement pay, couldn't it?
Well, I think we can do that in a work session.
Okay.
I think the issue is we have the words here. We can decide whether I'm not asking Senator Fry to move them as formal amendments. I'm asking, you know, everybody to take them down in pencil and make some decisions and Mr. McGoffin can think about it a little more and come back during work session and say yes, no, or how much it would cost and see what we're looking at with it. So that's the purpose in making sure we have it here. Okay? Senator Fry, you have anything else?
No, that's all, ma'am.
Okay.
Thank you.
If go ahead, Jim.
Madam Chair, we would proceed with item 2, page 3, line 18 and 19. Mm-hmm. The language of the amendment would ensure that continued police and fire coverage for former parole and probation officers of the state when transferring to county employment in positions described in ORS 181-610-5, the corrections officer definition. Our act has never been corrected since the Board of Parole and Probation was abolished. And this also speaks to another bill that you heard a few moments ago, which included the same correction, but went further and included the other civil deputies, et cetera. We had hoped to merely correct certainly a past inaction on our part in not cleaning up the act as far back as the Parole and Probation Board being abolished. It would pick up a number of individuals who are not now, to our knowledge, not now covered as police officers and firefighters.
That would pick up community corrections people in all or some instances, do you know?
County corrections individual.
Would come in.
And what happens is when an individual would transfer from state to the county, if they forwarded establishment of membership through that employment to us as a police officer, we would accept it. And so a number of them would already be covered as police officers and under the PNF coverage. Some, however, might not be. And in any event, Parole and Probation Board having been abolished, we felt that technically we ought to clean the act up, and that was merely an attempt on our part to do that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Fry.
Would that also include the parole and probation officers who are really private individuals that are hired on a contract basis, say, by...
They would have to meet the... qualified position requirement in the act.
Uh-huh. And we can look up what 181-610 is.
181-610 is defined, and Jerry has just handed me the definition. Parole and probation officer means any officer employed full-time by the corrections division, a county, or a court who is charged with and actually performs the duty of community protection by controlling, supervising, and providing reformative services for adult parolees and probationers, or who perform the duty of investigation of adult offenders on parole or probation or being considered for parole or probation.
I don't want to make any big deal in this, but I just want to make sure we're doing now what we intend to do here. There are, you know, individuals who are employed on a contract basis to do probation work. And could they...
Eventually will supply us with it. We ought to flag that and find out what that means with respect to some of the counties, whether those people, how they work them within each individual county retirement plan and how that fits with the corrections. So we'll inquire about that and get some information back. Jackie can flag that.
They're not employees, considered employees of public employees by the county and under... in an eligible position under the Act, they're independent contractors and they wouldn't be involved.
Yeah, well, okay, as long as the record shows that that's what we're thinking of instead of all these other folks.
It would not cover animal control officers. This amendment would not cover juvenile parole and probation officers, et cetera, et cetera.
Juvenile parole officers?
I would not be. They're not included in
okay.
Most everything. Animal, just the formalized parole corrections department. Okay.
Item 3, page 4, line 11, that language would clarify and make more logical and sensible the effective membership date of new members by allowing the 6-month probationary period to run unless interrupted by 30 consecutive rather than accumulative working days. It's been felt by staff for some time that the application that we have and the legal interpretation of that present language is too harsh and in effect in some cases keeps an individual from earning that 6-month probationary period and therefore membership. And the board agrees with staff that we should allow membership, not discourage it. Item 4 on page 5, we urge the deletion of this suggested amendment, not because the board opposes it, but because it is offered as an alternative accommodation in Senate Bill 368, which is being heard. Item 5 on page 8.
Okay, could I ask a question about that? If 5. Okay, so you essentially attempted to do somewhat was asking to be done in 368?
The Barr, Newberg, TRFA situation.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. When they first came to us.
Senator Cohen, we always believed that these people should have had the right to transfer.
And that's why we accepted the funds, and they are in their accounts at the present time. It's been the contention, a legal contention in the school district, that that portability is not allowed. Okay,
the committee then would needs to make a decision whether we want to include it in your bill or in 368, and if so, we need to check to make sure that the Riles amendments fit with what we have here, or somehow, if that's what the committee's direction is. So appreciate your comments on that. Okay?
Item 5, page 8, lines 20 and 21. The amendments would create the obligation to return not only withdrawn contributions upon return to employment by an employee within the statutory present 5-year period, but also they would be required by this amendment to return interest that would have accumulated during their separated period. The reason for the need, as envisioned by staff, is that the payment change from that our benefit payment change from annuities with a full formula, the individual now receives not just the return of his contributions, but he receives a full formula, which must be additionally funded when his account balance does not meet the annuity, the former 0.67 liability. And in all good conscience, we felt that where restorations are allowed and lump sums and restored funds are being required to return interest during this separated period, that this would also be clean, clear, and justifiable. Page 8, the sixth item, the language would prevent a member from retiring and drawing a lump sum distribution, and then with a 1% employer pension, and then upon reemployment applying for a full formula benefit. This seemed to us to be quite clearly a gap in the law, and one that we would rather address now than have it come in terms of a legal action. It is possible that we think at this point, without corrective legislation, for individuals to do just that, draw a lump sum distribution, and retire with his account balance and draw a 1% employer pension, and then being reemployed, apply for a full formula benefit. Once selected, the lump sum option under the language would be mandatory in all subsequent retirements. Item 7.
So once you take a lump sum out, you have to take any other
subsequent retirement benefit without a lump sum.
That
would clarify that.
I guess that's a policy decision I need to think a little bit more about or get some input about. I don't understand it completely, but I think I do. And I won't bog down things right now. I just want to.
Jerry, is there anything that can help clear?
Senator Cohen, what this would prevent is myself from retiring and cashing out my account, and then a year from now getting back on the payroll, working for a month, retiring, and now saying, my 33 years, I'm going to leave my account balance in, which is now only a couple hundred dollars, but give me the full 167 now. So I'd end up with the 167 plus the lump sum refund of my money. That's what we'd stop here.
That the language is not clear enough in the act
now.
Having gone to the full formula to stop that activity.
Okay.
We haven't had it occur, but rather than have it occur and then after the fact try to rectify it, we thought we'd better address it first. Page 9, item 7, the lines 21-23, the amendment would maintain the validity of a previously filed designation of beneficiary unless the member changed the designation in writing regardless of refunds or withdrawals. And that for the reason that we've had problems and occurrences of misunderstandings and almost fistfights.
Who is and who will not be
the beneficiary and whether or not an individual has. In this instance, then, once filed, the previously filed designation, unless the member changes it in writing, will remain his designation.
So they tell some other member of the family that, well, you're going to be my whatever, and then
get us involved. High. We have changed our format and our form, and we have a standard designation of beneficiary, and that helps a great deal, has helped us a great deal. But there still is the isolated instance where not so isolated. We've had 3 or 4 cases in the last year, and rather than finding ourselves in a legal battle, we would prefer clarifying that and leaving the last written designation in the file as the proper beneficiary.
Okay.
Page 9, item 8, the language would clear the distribution of employee accounts upon death. It would designate payment where there is no designated beneficiary directing payment to the estate if probated and then to the next of kin if no probate. Again, a technical correction, but one that has confronted us and given us some problems, and this clarifies. Item 9, page 10, line 39, page 11, line 1, would clarify and speed up distribution of benefits to survivors of deceased members in both probated and non-probated estates and prevent the payment of both a death benefit and a survivor option available to a retiring or disabled member within 120 days after terminating service. Again, a technicality in the Act, but a technicality that has occurred, and if occurring frequently, will involve us in some dual payments. And we hope to clarify that matter, and it's been facing us in a number of instances. Page 13, line 19 and 20, the final amendment would place individual active and retired employee records in an exempt status from disclosure, along with the majority of agency personnel information, personal information, the disclosure of which should be considered privileged and highly private and personal. And it was the board's desire to include the retirement system with other agencies under the Disclosure Acts on the matters of employee and retiree membership records, or that the individual accounts, the retirement benefits, the interest earned, and other personal data in the file, including disability medical records, a very important part of our record keeping, would not be available to anyone other than the member or under the member's direction.
Madam Chairman, on that.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, if you were given a subpoena to produce the records...
Well, in all instances, sir.
Pardon?
We recognize subpoena.
Oh, I see.
Powers.
All right. What kind of a situation would this preclude now that...
You calling up and asking about my account balance, or I calling up and asking about Senator Cohen's account balance or retirement allowance, or an estimate of her benefits, her medical records in case of a disability claim, et cetera.
Senator Cohen, one of the big one, addresses. They're always being asked for addresses of people, and we don't know who we're talking to.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
We'll find ourselves in unfortunate legal situations, a divorce, where an individual wants to know one thing without subpoenaing, and we not knowing it, I'm the spouse, sends in a note, says I'm the spouse. You answer and find out, oops, we're in hot water.
Okay, you satisfied,
yes.
Right, you can get the information if needed in there?
Yes.
Okay. Are there questions from other committee members that we haven't addressed as we go along? Anything else you'd like to share?
I think, yes. If I may, you did not get to, and hopefully we will soon be able to get to the restoration bills that are, so to speak, hanging fire. Mm-hmm. We've looked at the cost, and I believe it's Senate Bill 328.
Yes, that is it.
And we have will share with the Education Committee and have shared with your staff today our most recent actuarial cost estimates of some amendments that have been offered to that omnibus bill, 328, which will be heard tomorrow afternoon by Senate Education. And it is our conclusion that with the suggested amendments, especially in the area of 10-year service requirement and the recovery of 1 year for every 3 years that have been worked, that there will be minimal cost to the system, and it will help alleviate that restoration problem. The committee seems excited, the Senate Education Committee seems excited about that solution, and I would think that...
Those are the buyback.
That
is for committee members who are not with 328 is a omnibus buyback bill and is in Senate.
With that concept, we staff would estimate that the majority of the people who are out there today and are looking for the restoration of that service and the recovery of it by restoring withdrawn contributions will have that 10 years of service and will have in that neighborhood of 3-to-1 ratio, probably be able to pick up the majority of that service. And it will be rewarding career employment, and will be, because spread over the total membership and employer liability, 30-year amortization period, a respectable minimal cost to the system. It's a step, certainly, in that direction. It's not a total solution. There'll always be someone with 9 years of service, or 7 years, or six, or five. But
does that have any... effect on all these other bills we're considering?
Well, it could have an effect on certainly on 371. Is it 371?
Yeah.
371 and 372 would, in a sense, replace 371 and 372, or could do so, and we'll be back in touch with committee members individually with the amendments from the Education Committee. We can make a recommendation to Ways and Means based on the majority of the committee chooses to do so. We will be discussing that, even though it's specifically not, the 328 is not in this committee, but we can certainly discuss the concepts, replace one of those bills with the amended 328 if the committee wishes to do that. I just want to serve notice that we will be discussing that next time we work on these bills. Thank you very much. And we will get to your offices, Jackie will get the amendments to 328 so that you can look them over and see exactly what they are proposing and what Mr. Goffman's office is currently looking at. I'd like to hear, before we adjourn, from Mr. Lemon, who came from the Department of Higher Education, from Eugene, and Ken, you can come back, I guess.
But we have, Professor Tull is here, and he might sit up here with us, witness, Madam Chairman.
Very well. Pleased to do that. I couldn't tell where people are from here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bill Lemon, Vice Chancellor for the State System of Higher Education. You kindly received some amendments at your last meeting that we had offered, and I'm here to support the bill in all aspects, including those amendments, and including the amendments offered by Senator Frye today. My only purpose is to make certain that the committee has an adequate understanding of the proposed amendments and the reasons underlying them. I won't offer testimony unless you have questions on those bills. On those amendments, I'd be pleased to explain them if you are uncertain or uncomfortable about them. But I know that you're anxious to conclude your meeting.
Senator, do you want to ask
I'd like
your vice. What your vice?
Vice Chancellor for Administration.
Yes, I just want to get these titles right. The Vice Chancellor, a question, or we can go ahead to Mr. Tull.
Yes,
whichever is easier to do. Maybe you might have.
Either one could answer. I think I've only got one question.
Let's ask Mr. Tull to identify yourself for the record and forward on your concerns and so that we can get both of you on the record for questioning.
My name is Don Tull, and I'm a professor at the School of Business, University of Oregon. Would you like to raise your question, Senator Frye, or should
I? Madam Chairman, I just wanted to ask Professor Tull to speak to the amendment that I suggested, if he could.
I'm appearing here because I strongly support Senator Frye's amendment. The question came up earlier as to whether, in fact, faculty members had signed agreements with the understanding that the incentive pay that was involved in the agreement, generally 6% at the University of Oregon, I suspect that's the same at the other institutions, would be included in the salary on which the calculation was made with regard to retirement pay. The answer to that is certainly yes. I'm a case in point. I signed an agreement in October of 1980, a year before the administrative ruling that invoked, and with the clear understanding on my part that that would be included in the calculations of my retirement pay. And of course, if that weren't the case, this would be an unintentional but nonetheless a very real revocation of the understanding that I had. So. And there are many other faculty members who have this same understanding.
Okay. Senator Frye, you had
That's all I had.
Okay, we do have the wording that you brought forward via Senator Frye. And is there any other question, anything else you'd like to share with us? Thank you for coming.
Again, hoping
Thank
that you,
very you much.
Have an understanding of the purpose. And
yes, I think
do,
we did have a somewhat at length discussion last time during the public hearing.
Madam Chairperson, if I could maybe add one concern. I think universities have a special need to bring in new people, new faculty. There's evidence that people in the physical sciences, the mathematics, for example, by the age 45 have contributed to a great extent the new knowledge that they're going to contribute. And so new young people are quite important, and I think this program will be much more effective in permitting universities to bring in these people if the incentive pay is allowed to be a part of the base pay on which retirement is calculated.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have Tom Kramer, Kirk Berger, and Ken Johnson, and I guess I'd ask you to wait until we come, if you don't mind, you're back in again. I want to thank everybody for being patient, and especially the committee members that got through this bill, and we'll do a work session on all of them. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairman.